While voting experts repeatedly deny the claims of voter fraud leveled by the Trump administration and some of its Republican allies, government attempts to erect barriers at the ballot box by imposing strict voter ID laws, cutting voting times, restricting registration, and purging voter rolls are both very real and show no sign of slowing. Yet those efforts aimed at marginalizing this country's First Peoples are generally glossed over by our media, if not outright ignored. In her new book, Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches, Jean Schradel gives context to these ongoing efforts to negate Native American voters. Although the relatively small numbers of Native Americans and the geographic isolation of reservation lands contribute to the collective amnesia from which our country suffers, Schradel is convinced that what happens in Indian country is crucial to determining whether the arc of the moral universe does indeed bend toward justice. Schradel is a professor of public policy at Claremont Graduate University and one of the few scholars working in the domain of Native voting access, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I so appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you. It's a great opportunity.
What do we know when it comes to the voting patterns as far as the access to voting for Native Americans?
That's a great comment question, Joe, because, I mean, some of the tactics are very similar to what are used to suppress voting among some other populations. But I always like to say there's typically what I call a unique twist. And so it'll be similar, but then with an added element. So, for example, if we think about the closing of polling places, I mean, we know that large numbers of polling places have been closed, well over 1,000, and that those are disproportionately in minority communities, particularly focused on African Americans. So we know polling closures are going on, and the academic data shows that if you move a polling place or the distance that someone has to travel to vote by as little as a quarter of a mile, turnout decreases. So a lot of work has shown how this affects African Americans, and all to the good. But what happens when we're talking about Native populations is the distance when you close polling places is astronomically larger. I was trying to think of the right word. So, for example, there is a reservation in northern Nevada called the Duck Valley Reservation, and I visited there a few years ago, and people there told me they used to have a polling place on the reservation, but that the state had closed it down. And so after it was closed, if they wanted to vote by person, in person, they had to travel a couple hundred miles. So we're not talking a quarter mile, we're talking a couple hundred miles. So as I said, there's differences, but with twists. Or right now, voting by mail is a hot issue. The media is paying an enormous amount of attention, right, and all to the good. But there are differences when we talk about voting by mail in what's called Indian country. If you or I'm guessing, please note, excuse me for making an assumption, but typically for most of us, if we want to vote by mail, all we have to do is walk a few steps out our door to our post office or to our box, mailbox, right, you know, to either get or put the ballot. If you don't have home mail delivery, then it's a much bigger issue. And most reservations do not have home mail delivery. So there's a distance added. But again, when I was saying much greater. So, for example, in the Navajo Nation reservation, which is mostly is in Arizona, but it also cuts over into Utah and New Mexico, that reservation is larger than the state of West Virginia. No mail home mail delivery. West Virginia has 725 post offices. Navajo Nation has 40, and it's not all post offices. Some of them are what are called postal provider offices, which are contract, a couple hours open in a mini mart or a gas station, which means people have to travel. Not only do they not get mail at home, they have to travel a very long distance in some cases to actually get mail. I mean, there's one part on the reservation, and I kid you not, 871 square mile area without a single post office.
You make the point early in the book that many non-Native Americans are very unclear about the citizenship status of Native people. That would include many of the people who are actually asking for us to vote for them. So how does that play into this? And then to take it one step further, which is how much of this is intentional and how much of it is just because it is a relatively small number that it's overlooked?
Wow. Okay, there's a lot in that.
So basically explain your entire book in three. No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's great, but I may lose part of it as I go along, so bear with me.
I will.
All right. Okay, President Reagan, and I, you know, it speaks to how little most of us understand about Native Americans. President Reagan, when he was in office, actually said they were not U.S. citizens, which is pretty mind-boggling given he was president of supposedly the entire country. But I find myself these days feeling nostalgic for Reagan, which is really scary. But okay, end of editorializing. Most of us who are not Native, we have two citizenships. We're dual citizens, even if we don't know it. We have national citizenship and we have state citizenship. And that's important because different rights are accorded to each type of citizenship. So, for example, state citizenship, not national citizenship, was used by the courts in the latter part of the 19th century to argue that women could not have the vote. The Supreme Court said, voting, determinants of who is eligible to vote and everything about voting is a function of state citizenship, and women, therefore, cannot have it unless their state allows them. So we have dual citizenship. I have dual citizenship. I'm not Native. I'm a shining bright white lady. But if you belong to one of the 574 federally recognized tribes, you have a third level of citizenship. You have your tribal citizenship as well. It doesn't take anything away from being a U.S. citizen, a citizen of your state, but it's a third level of citizenship that is contingent or affected by the relationship that that tribe has with the federal government, enshrined in treaties and so on. So that's, I think, the first part of your question. The second, if I've got it right, and please jump in if I don't.
I will.
Was the question as to whether or not the lack of knowledge or the suppression the lack of knowledge about these issues is intentional?
Right.
Did I get that right?
Correct. Okay. So are they doing it on purpose or is it overlooking?
Okay. Thank you. I think both goes on, okay, to be fair. And there's certainly instances of absolutely intentional discrimination and suppression. You can see it, for example, well, this election right now, South Dakota, as most of us are aware, has been in the forefront of we're not doing anything to shut down because of COVID.
Right.
It's certainly intentional in some places, and I think we can see that. The example I would give is Jackson County, South Dakota. Jackson County lost or settled a voting rights suit which required them to open up a polling place on the reservation. In this case, the lower half of Jackson County in South Dakota is part of the Pine Ridge Reservation. Northern part is entirely white. So they were forced to open up a polling place, early voting site on the reservation. Again, no home mail delivery and so on. So Jackson County is the only place that I know of in South Dakota that is using COVID and arguing that because of COVID, they have to close something down. In this case, they have chosen to close the early voting site, the only one on the reservation, the Pine Ridge Reservation in the county, not closing access off reservation to early voting, but on reservation. Now, do I know what is in their absolute hearts and souls? No, I can't look in there. I lack that ability,
right.
But it's hard not to see that as intentional.
But you talk to people for the book, lawyers, Native people who are active in voting rights. They have stories of deception. They have stories of lying, and to the lengths that they have to which politicians and political elites have gone to keep them from voting.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the parts that I enjoyed the most, was the opportunity to talk and get to know a number of really interesting people who are engaged in this struggle. And I'm happy that I've been able, at least to some extent, to give voice to their stories. And so, yeah, I mean, some of the things are almost mind-boggling. So, for example, in 2018, it was a man named Willie Gray Eyes, and he was running to serve on the San Juan County, it's in Utah, on the county commission. And San Juan County had never had a majority Native on their county council. And Gray Eyes, if he won, would tip the balance of the county commissioners. And what happened is he got the Democratic nomination for District 2, I think it was 2, and it looked like he was going to win, and the county decided that he was not eligible. They removed him from the ballot, just arbitrarily. And the argument is, they said, Willie Gray Eyes doesn't live within the county. Well, he had lived in the same place for 30 years. Evidence that they presented, a deputy sheriff had gone to his home, he was not there, and said he didn't see tire tracks that showed that Gray Eyes had been there recently. I mean, how can that not be intentional? Good news is Gray Eyes went to court, forced them to put him back on the ballot, and he won. Other stories, as an example of one of the ones that really hurts is there was an attorney named Patty Ferguson Bonet. She works at Arizona State University Indian Law Clinic. And she told me the story of an elderly Navajo woman. And this woman had always voted, and she used her thumbprint for her identity. But when they passed the ID laws, voter ID laws, she realized she had to get a U.S. government-issued identification. So she went to the local DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles office, the closest one to the reservation, and they told her they didn't issue these documents. Well, they usually do, but anyhow, leaving that aside, so she then went to the Indian Law Clinic, and she went back that same day with Patty Ferguson Bonet, with a lawyer, and again the DMV told them, no, we don't give those identification documents here. So they then traveled to the main DMV office in Flagstaff and took in the documents from the tribe, and the DMV rejected those documents. This is an elderly woman. She spent 8 hours trying to get an ID to be able to vote. And finally, Ferguson Bonet threatened them with legal action, and they gave her an identification card. But, yeah, you shouldn't have to go to a lawyer and spend 8 hours driving hundreds of miles to be able to get a document to show that you actually did live where you have lived and spent your entire life and be able to vote.
I caution with this question because it may come off wrong, but my question is how active and how much do, and realize this is probably anecdotal as well, but the want to vote by the Native American people?
Well, that's, again, you've got really good questions. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, one of the things that I have done, I'm part of what's called the Native American Voting Rights Coalition, and we did surveys of Native Americans in four states, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, South Dakota. And I worked with folks from a group called Four Directions, which is a Native grassroots organization, to handle the parts in Nevada and South Dakota. And it was interesting because one of the things we asked were about how often people voted in tribal elections and non-tribal elections. And participation was much higher in tribal elections than it was in non-tribal elections. So it was kind of an interesting, so there was a clear sense of people who were engaged. So then we moved on and we had questions about whether they trusted government and whether they trusted whether their votes would count. And it was really striking. When it came to trust in votes that count in the non-tribal elections, very low levels of trust. For example, in South Dakota, the trust level they had for going to in-person voting was only 38%. But if you went to vote by mail, it dropped down to 24%. If you don't believe that your vote's going to count, you're much less likely to vote. And I think one of the reasons, if we look at voting by mail, is the low level of trust, the extraordinarily low level of trust, if you will, is that when you vote by mail, that local election official makes a determination as to whether your vote will count. So it goes into someone and they have your name, at least on the outside of an envelope, so they know who you are, where your ballot comes from. If you live in an area that has a lot of, well, let's just call it racial animosity or history of racial discrimination, you're much less likely to trust that local official as to whether they will count your ballot. And there's data that has come out from Arizona showing that when you look at ballots that are discarded, that the discard rate or the rejection rate of ballots from the Native American precincts are 8 times higher than the rates that come out of the white precincts. And it can be, of course, people can make mistakes in their ballots. These are areas that oftentimes were places where there was incidents, massacres, lots of military conflicts between Native people and the U.S. military. And so there's this long-term history of distrust and, quite frankly, racial animus in many of these places. And you can see how this comes in when it comes to trust in government. So we did surveys. I was part of the Native American Voting Rights Coalition, and we did surveys, and I was part of surveying 1,500 Native Americans in South Dakota and Nevada. We asked questions about how much trust they had in different levels of government, and it was interesting, the very lowest levels of trust were in local and state government, which are the entities that oversee elections. But we also asked about trust in different forms of voting. So we asked about in-person election day voting and voting by mail. And the levels of trust for both were disturbingly low. Trust in Nevada in-person election day voting did you completely trust it was only 45%. Voting by mail dropped down to 28%. If we turn to South Dakota, a state that's had some of the worst instances of racial tension, unrest between Native people and non-Native people. In South Dakota, the level of trust in Election Day voting, and again, these are for non-tribal elections, was only 38%, and vote by mail was 24%. And this data is troubling. I mean, first off, it's troubling the low levels of trust in government entities, and it's troubling that in no place did they trust at least 50% that their vote would count, which is very disturbing. But if we turn to the differences between in-person voting on Election Day and voting by mail, keep in mind that on Election Day, you go, you fill out your ballot, you put it in the box, or if you're in a place where you pull a lever, and it goes in and it mixes with everybody else's vote. So nobody can identify your personal vote and who you are. Voting by mail, your ballot goes in to a local election official who knows who you are, where you live, and knows how you vote. And so there's not that confidentiality. And what we see is in places that there's been racial animosity, it's easy to understand why one might not trust that that election official would treat you fairly, whether they would or not. I mean, I'm guessing most are decent, but it's easy to see the low levels of trust. But we also know from research that was done, for example, there was research in the last couple years in Arizona looking at the rejection of voting by mail ballots and found that in precincts that were Native American, they had a rejection rate that was 8 times higher than the rejection rate in the precincts that were overwhelmingly white. Doesn't necessarily mean evil intent. You can reject a ballot because somebody left it blank, left parts of that you had to fill out, didn't sign it. You know, so there's reasons that officials can legitimately reject ballots. But what one would like is in those places that individuals are given an opportunity to cure them, to fix mistakes that might be little things. Or if the election official looks at your signature and thinks it doesn't match the one on file, allow you to come in and prove that you are who you say you are. I mean, lots of people, as they get older, their signatures change. Right. So you can see how all of these things come together to result in a lack of trust.
So two questions. One is, how optimistic are you for a fairness in the election this time? And given the way that this particular administration has had a policy toward that has affected Native peoples, whether it be drilling in the Arctic Refuge or bear ears or pipelines or ... does that have a positive impact on the support for a Joe Biden as president, or do we get back to the overall trust issue?
Wow, a lot in there, Joe.
I know. I'm trying to make the most of my 5 minutes.
Okay. I mean, are there going to be attempts with the fairness question about the election?
Yes.
Sure, there are people who are going to try their very, very best to intimidate. I mean, what is there? There's a call for the Republicans, and Donald Trump are calling for people to come to the polling places to, quote, protect them. We have seen that in the past in Indian Country and the Pine Ridge Reservation. The sheriff would come and stand outside of the polling place looking like a character out of the 19th century with a big cowboy hat and big gun and look very intimidating. So I'm sure we're going to see more of that. But I will tell you, I'm also optimistic. I'm optimistic because when someone tells you, you can't do this, yeah, there is a tendency on people to say some version, I don't want to use a cuss word on the air, but blank you, you know, I'm going to do it. So
right.
The more folks push and say you can't vote, the more there will be a counter reaction.
So given all that we have talked about, where does your optimism lie as far as the integrity of this election when it comes to voting in Indian country?
I think there's going to be attempts to suppress it, to do various things to discourage people from voting. But generally speaking, I'm cautiously optimistic. When people are told you can't do something, you're denied this, you know, there's a natural pushback. And you say, well, if you say I can't do that, well, darn well, I'm going to do it. And we saw that in 2018 in the North Dakota election, where the Supreme Court, 3 weeks before the general election, allowed North Dakota to put in place a law that would have disenfranchised about 5,000 people on the reservation because the law required that they have residential street addresses on identification, knowing full well that there were not residential addressing on the reservations. But what happened is people worked crazy hours to create addresses using GIS and then creating identification documents. And the turnout was higher than it ever been recorded in the past. So I think the more things that the Trump people and whatever term you wish to use for the folks who are trying to suppress the vote, the more people are going to push back and say, I am going to vote. It is my right as a U.S. citizen. And I'm cautiously optimistic that people will be successful.
Jean Trudell is the Thornton Bradshaw Professor of Public Policy at Claremont Graduate University. She is also the author of the new book, Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. The book is published by University of Pennsylvania Press. You did not hear it during the course of this interview, but she is also a great trooper because it took us a really long time technologically to get this all together. I thank you very much for your time. I thank you for your patience, and I thank you for the great work you're doing.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Again, Jean Trudell is the author of Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. The book is published by Penn. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.